Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
This is Dmitry Samarov from Chicago, Illinois. And I love listening to Vish Khanna's Creative Control because whether he's talking to a favorite musician or actor of mine or someone I've never heard of, it's as if he's introducing me to a new friend. And the way things are going, couldn't you use a new friend? Listen now.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Steve Albini is a musician, songwriter, poker player, and recording engineer based in Chicago, Illinois. A member of notable bands like Big Black and Shellac, Albini owns and operates the renowned Electrical Audio Recording Facility in Chicago and has appeared on the Creative Control podcast in some capacity at least once a year since its inception in 2013. In this particular instance, Steve and I connected to have a discussion that covered how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted the work of the Unconditional Giving Poverty Alleviation Charities organization and its annual Letters to Santa program, which is spearheaded by Steve's wife, Heather Winna, and will engage in a star-studded 24-hour improv event to raise funds for those in need on December 22nd, 2020. Steve gave me his take on the political state and global standing of the United States of America. He talked about some really fun text threads he's involved in. He also discussed the grim status of his recording studio, Electrical Audio, because of how the U.S. government has neglected its citizens and its economy during this pandemic. Steve talked about where in the world he might have moved to had the 2020 U.S. presidential election gone differently. He gave me his response to Elvis Costello's recent disparagements about Steve's work with PJ Harvey. We talked about the Houston Astros World Series cheating controversy and the genius of play-by-play commentator Steve Stone. We talked about the status of Shellac's next album and a forthcoming compilation of singles, B-sides, and other rarities recorded by the band throughout their trajectory together. And we talked about a whole lot of other stuff, too. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, and also Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Destroyer. Plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 589th episode of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Steve Albini, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Steve. How's it going?
You know, everything's awful.
Yeah, I knew the answer was going to be something along those lines, but I ask it anyway because it's in the grand scheme of things, how are things going? How about maybe I should have phrased it that way.
Yeah, in the grand scheme of things, everything is awful, yeah.
Everything is still awful. Okay, where in the world are you today?
Chicago, Illinois, my hometown.
Nice. And what's going on in Chicago? How are things in Chicago? Normally, when we talk around this time of year, we get to talk about the letters to Santa.
Yeah.
Your wife, Heather, has this program where she helps people who are unhoused or are not doing so well. Right off the top, what is the state of that program given, you know, the circumstances we're in?
Yeah, the global pandemic has really just affected absolutely every aspect of life. And we're... like the charity that she runs is called unconditionalgiving.org, the poverty alleviation charities. And the Letters to Santa program is an annual fundraising thing where we raise money and bring it to poor people on Christmas. And we can't go to poor people's homes now. It's not safe to go to other people's homes for them. It's not safe for us, but it's primarily we're concerned about being a vector, bringing the coronavirus to other people. So we're staying socially distant. Also, the aid organizations that we use to locate families that need help have no in-person services at the moment. So enrollment is down in all of those programs. And it's just a terrible year, not just because it's a terrible year, but because it's affected all of our ability to help people.
Yeah.
So we are still going to do the annual 24-hour marathon show. It's going to be an online live stream event. The details will be at the charity website at unconditionalgiving.org and at 24hourimprov.com/2020. Mm-hmm. But the money that we're raising, we're not going to be able to distribute in person. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to use the aid organizations that we use to identify families and distribute the money through them. But we're doing it. It's all we know how to do. And it's a very dim glimmer of hope in a very bleak year.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I appreciate that work. That sounds great. Sorry, what was that website again? I just want to make sure we get that.
There's unconditionalgiving.org is the poverty alleviation charities website, and if you go there, there, you should be able to navigate to any of the programs that the charity runs and the 24-hour marathon show once it's been finalized.
I assume in other years that weren't impacted by a pandemic, people around the world could donate to this charity via that site.
You still can.
Okay. And then dispersal of the funds will be more difficult. I know you it's true, you and Heather and other people, you go to people's houses, don't you? You used to do that, right?
I mean, that's the whole routine is we raise a bunch of money, we find people who need, and they articulate their need through letters, originally letters addressed to Santa that were left at the post office, but now letters addressed to Santa that are collected by the aid organizations that we work with, notably the Onward Neighborhood House on the west side of Chicago, but also their affiliated NGO social services organizations and charities around the city. Last year, we expanded and we started doing Christmas deliveries in Oakland, California as well. There's a charitable partner out there, and there's a school that we work with out there.
Yeah.
That found us families, and we did the day after Christmas, we did some deliveries in Oakland last year. We had hoped to carry on with that and expand it, but this year has just been miserable, just been a grinding torture the entire year. So,
I mean, you sound as often you, I find you often sound resolute in your belief that things can happen, that things can, then, you know, you can affect positive change. You also, as a person, as a citizen, I hear it in your voice. You sound frustrated and despondent.
Well, I'm a realist, you know. Our only hope at any kind of a coordinated national response was getting Trump out of office. Okay, job done, you know, step one underway. But now we have to wait. We're just waiting out the garbage time of the Trump pregnancy of the Trump presidency. And, you know, when the buzzer finally rings and Biden can work with a presumably slightly more sympathetic Congress, maybe we can get some substantive aid through. But until then, everyone is just hanging on by their fucking fingernails. You know, it's just everybody's broke. Nobody can do anything. People are losing their jobs, losing their homes. It's the worst year ever. Zero stars this year.
Yeah. I noticed that you gave it that rating on its Yelp. This trolling doesn't seem like it's going to end now. I don't mean to go further into the abyss of despair, but what is occurring to me up here in Edmonton, Alberta, in Canada, is that this guy and his ilk are not going to go anywhere after January 20th. They're just going to troll us forever.
Well, I don't care. I just want them neutralized. I don't care what they think or what they're, you know, I don't care what the rationale for their behavior is. I'm not interested in finding common ground with them. I'm not interested in comprehending their pain. I want them neutralized. I want them to be the marginalized, comical remnant of a failed and embarrassing episode, you know?
Yeah. What is the media's role in this going forward, though? Because that's something I'm monitoring. Will they deplatform them, so to speak, and stop covering this bullshit? Or
no, there is an audience for this, you know, wackadoodle stuff, and the wackadoodles there are enough of them, and they can be cultivated like mushrooms. So there are enough of them now, and there will be some cultivation done for them. So they're actually, that, you know, it's going to be, they're like, you know, in the same way that there are, you know, still lingering deadheads and rockabilly enthusiasts and, you know, any other kind of thing that you thought we were done with, you know, there will be these proto-fascist nut jobs. Our job as a society is to neutralize them. It's not to educate them. That's not a possibility. It's not to work with them or find common ground with them. It's to make sure that they are irrelevant. when you say the media, you're actually talking, you're not talking about a single monolithic entity. You're talking about this fractious and fractured landscape where you have small market AM radio stations in rural areas that are monopolistically owned by large corporations that really don't care, don't have an agenda other than making money. And then you have some ideologically driven people in broadcast who have vacuumed up local television stations, and people like the Sinclair Group, who now own an enormous number of broadcast outlets and have an avowed right-wing slant. Like, if they think that their easiest path toward maximizing their income is by, you know, sort of encouraging the wackadoodles, then they will, you know.
Yeah.
But that's why I mean we need to marginalize them. I mean, we need to neutralize them. We need to make it so that they are not welcome in businesses. We need to make it so that they find no comfort, and so that their economic muscle can't be exploited. Their economic power can't be exploited by the people who feed their insanity.
Well, I want to draw a distinction between what you're saying about neutralizing such people and organizations and ignoring them, because I have built up a kind of a full body callus. When someone's trolling me, I'm able to ignore it, and I mean just. I just don't acknowledge it. But
oh,
I feel
believe
like,
I understand that practice. I have skin like a rhino myself.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, did we make a mistake somehow in ignoring these people? Like, I get what you're saying. I don't want to make peace with them. I don't get it. But to live in vacuums, I think, has maybe caused some of us to be like, what? QAnon? People think that? How can they do that? And I wonder if just like keeping tabs on it might have been a better way to go somehow. I don't really want to, because it will occupy mental space. I could be shoving other stuff in there. But do you know where I'm coming from a little bit?
I appreciate what you're saying, but you cannot engage with these people because they aren't using language the same way that we are. They aren't using discourse and language to learn or further a discussion or debate in good faith. They're just getting reps in on their trolling, right?
Yeah,
so you cannot engage with these people. What you do is you make it so that they know that their ideas are unwelcome on any platform that you have influence on, and you let them know on a personal level that you will not engage with them in that way.
Yeah.
Like, I don't see any value in trying to manage a patently insane group of people, like people who literally deny tangible reality.
Yeah.
I don't see any value in engaging with a cult like that. And I think it's going to burn itself out the way all of these things do. We just need to minimize the damage that it does in the meantime.
Yeah, that's fair. I want your take on something because it's been puzzling me a little bit. I understand that the outgoing president and many, most, if not all, Republicans generally are motivated by selfish impulses, shitty behavior. But I think on the year, I wonder what your take is on why they all almost immediately downplayed the pandemic. I know some of the rationale here.
Well,
when it started, but what I want to say though is they've stuck to that stance. They've refused to do anything to alleviate it, and the devastation is irrefutable. They're just distorting obvious facts and they're being called on it. But I guess I don't get that. Why would you not want to?
Policy was established in the U.S. to protect the businesses that exploit people who work in dangerous environments.
Right.
So policy was principally, like, when meatpacking plants were the principal vector for transmission and they were the hothouses where the cases were, immediately there was legislation passed to establish that meatpacking workers were essential and to protect meatpacking plants from litigation and to, you know, like, basically the policy was set to defend the investment class and the people who were profiting from the exploitation of labor in dangerous circumstances, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's how policy was set, and it just hasn't changed. It's just carried on that way. And all the arguments about personal liberty, all of those things are cover for wanting businesses to be able to continue to make money by exploiting service workers, by exploiting delivery people, by exploiting people who have to work in confines and congregate with other people.
Yeah. That's it.
It's pretty transparent. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, genuine freedom. It's literally just about making sure that the wealthy people who make money from exploiting labor carry on, you know, protecting that investment, protecting that profit margin.
So is the you know, repeated public denial of the science and suggestions that, you know, we're rounding the corner, on the other side, that's signaling to that base, that base of investors, to be like, don't worry, I got you. That's what you think? I just don't get that part of it.
That messaging is driven by, specifically by Donald Trump's perception that illness is weakness.
Yes, yes.
And that if you are sick, you are a flawed person, and that it's not just that it's your fault, it's that you are irredeemable for having become sick, you know.
Yeah.
And he can't imagine being the president of a country where people are getting sick, and so he just claims that it isn't happening.
Right. Right. Do you think he is in cognitive decline, or do you think he's just an asshole?
I don't think it matters. I mean, like I said, we're in the garbage time of his presidency now. There's nothing that he does or says is going to have any consequence from this point on. So I don't care, and I don't want to spend any energy thinking about it.
Okay, fair enough.
I also don't think that there's a meaningful distinction between someone who's a narcissist psychopath and someone who is in cognitive decline. I mean, I suppose the difference is that if someone is in cognitive decline, they were at one point caring, an empathetic and caring person. It's possible.
Right.
But Donald Trump never has been. He has always been precisely the person that we see. And I don't think that's made worse by him losing brain cells, you know.
Sure. Fair enough. Yeah. Over the years, you and I have had many conversations. Occasionally we have bantered about Canada, and, you know, you've made little jokes about Canada over the years, and I appreciate that. But
our kid brother country.
Yes, there you go. There it is. That's what I was looking for. There's the stuff. I like it. I don't remember. I used this the other day. Did you used to call? Who called Canada America's hat? Was that you?
I'm sure I have at some point. Yeah, I like it.
I can't. I used it the other day with someone, one of your fellow Americans, and I making a joke, and I thought of you because I'm like, did I just rip off Steve there? Did you coin that? It's a funny idea. But anyway, my point here is, so much has been going on in this year. So much has come to light, like stuff some of us who've been paying attention are aware of. You know, social unrest, police violence, these kinds of things. So I want to frame this question as carefully and as diplomatically as I can, Steve. Because I feel like in your jabbing of Canada, there's a little bit of American superiority. And I wonder, is America actually a good place? And if so, what to you about it is still good? Because I'm struggling a little bit. Again,
yeah, I mean,
I love you. I don't be insulted. I'm just saying, now I'm starting to think about it a bit more. And like, what is good about it? What do you like about it?
Relative to the United States, Canada is crushing it at the moment, you know.
This is not me. We have lots of issues.
Right.
Horrible systemic problems. We have, I live now in a libertarian province. I live in the province with the worst caseload. I moved from a province that was heading that way and is not doing well either, but in a worse, there's like a state of emergency here. We can't leave our homes. Like, it's finally happened. So this is not superiority. I'm being sincere. Like, I've followed American culture and politics my whole life. And now I'm like, what have I invested my time in? on some level.
Yeah, I honestly, there's a friend of mine that lives in Montreal. He was originally Australian, and he said, you know, when he was a kid, it always seemed like the ambition was to end up in America, where, you know, the center of everything, where everything happens, you know. And then as an adult, he lived here lived in New York for a while. He interned at the studio for a brief period, and then he moved to Montreal, and he's been in Montreal ever since. And now, and he was reflecting on it, and he's like, now when I think about where would I like to go, like, America isn't even on the list.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, where
yeah.
would you like to end up? And it is a shit show here. Like, we have blown so many of our, we had substantive advantages on the whole rest of the world. We had all the money, we invented everything, we had all the companies, we had all the technological advancements. Like, we, you know, we were doing everything.
Yeah.
20th century was like pretty much ours, you know. And since then, we've just shit the bed nonstop.
Do you have any perspective on why exactly? Like, why is your country so divided? Like, we are now very, you know, it started out as maybe a little bit of a joke, but we are invoking the phrase civil war
yeah.
with a little bit more weight. Like, it's actually, as your president calls for people to arm up, violence is going to ensue. People are being threatened
yeah.
for counting votes. Like, that is a really obviously horrible place to be. And
yeah, I think there's a when you say that we are divided, what's happened is that being an asshole has become part and parcel of an identity that is now aspirational for some people, whereas mm-hmm. being an asshole was just a character flaw previously. So there are people for whom just being belligerent and unfeeling and uncaring and like a sociopath, where people identify with that as a role model, essentially.
Yeah.
The notion that we are a divided country kind of belies the fact that there have always been these divisions, you know, racism, sexism, class divides, like those mm-hmm. have mm-hmm. always been there, and they have often been more stark. And mobility has often been institutionally prevented, like the red lines in real estate and sexist language in law and, you know, racist language in law, things like that. Like, a lot of that has changed. The institutional barriers in a lot of places, a lot of ways have come down.
Yeah.
But people are still identifying with the tribes that they grew up with, and they have hardened themselves toward the people that are not like them. And that's, yeah, I think that's, I wish I could tell you what the curative for that is, you know. I have a small yeah. number of friends who identify as conservative, or, you know, who are more conservative than me at any rate.
Yeah.
And if you engage them in debate, they will debate in good faith a lot of the priors and presumptions that they carry with them sound insane to me and don't comport with my worldview and don't comport with my experience. But I don't believe that they are as delusional as the wingnut, you know, people that, you know, the blind Trump supporters.
Yeah. Okay. So you have touched upon delusion. You've touched upon assholery. One of the things that I'm really, as you know, I'm a parent with children, and, you know, bringing them, I don't want to go this cliche route, but I am thinking about it as we sometimes the news is on and they process certain things and they ignore others. But I'm curious about your take on what has happened to lying.
Yeah.
Because the extent to which a kind of new form of lying, often in the form of projection, I've not seen this before, where you say, you, a lot of this assholery is, what can I get away with? What
yeah,
can
exactly.
I do to get away with something? And also, this, one of the strategies that Trump has done his whole life that is spreading is, when I do something that I know, or maybe they don't know it because they're sociopaths, but if I do something that is illegal, I'm going to accuse someone else
yeah.
of doing that exact thing.
Well, that's a very old, that was a Nazi propaganda technique.
Yes.
You accuse the other side of that which you are guilty. And it sounds insane when it's coming out of your mouth, but you just keep doing it. And what it does is it deadens and neutralizes the terms of accusation. Because there's a, you know, let's say you say, oh, these people are rigging the election. Well, I mean, there's no more obvious or blatant rigging of an election than the gerrymandering that was an explicit part of the red state campaign that the Republicans have been running since the late 80s, right?
Yeah.
So they are clearly guilty of rigging elections. And so they accuse the other side of rigging an election. And what that does is it eventually makes that term meaningless. It eventually makes it so that you can't use that term without there being some question about which side you're addressing. Whereas previously it would have been, you know, before they started making those accusations, it would have been clear what you were talking about.
Yeah, it's childish. It's like it's a two kids being like, you're stupid. No, you're stupid.
It's a way of distorting the language so that the behavior is no longer associated with the term. So, like, the Republicans can carry on rigging elections knowing that no one can say they are rigging elections because they have bought that term.
Have you seen this thread, this tweet thread about Mitch McConnell that someone started? I think it was yesterday as we're speaking. They basically, they went through they couldn't understand it. He had an 18% popularity rate and apparently won by 57% of the vote. And they're like, well, how is this possible? And as they went through it, they realized that all the stuff that Trump has been saying about those Dominion machines in terms of it having an algorithm that you could vote flip with, you know, apparently Kentucky, South Carolina, these kinds of places where Lindsey Graham won, Mitch McConnell won, apparently they use a kind of machine that does that. And so so now we're in this zone where, like you say, it's hard now for it just becomes noise because everyone's kind of flinging mud at each other. But like this tweet thread is incredible. I it's very extensive and well reported, I think. I mean, you know, here I am just reading a tweet thread. I don't know if it's true. Do you know what I'm talking about? Are you aware of this one?
I don't. And constitutionally, I'm inclined to believe that Mitch McConnell would do anything to stay in power. So I am credulous, but I also haven't read it. So I shouldn't
say. I'll share it with you after we're done here, just so you can, if you want. Also, are you, I'm trying to do a thing where I don't read the news at night before bed because it's so, you know, it's hard to sleep. Are you insulating at all? I know you try to stay informed.
No,
but do you?
My problem is that I have been trapped in my house for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And I feel like electronic connections with the outside world are some of the only connections I have with the outside world. You know, like I can ride my bike to work and see my neighborhood, and you know, I can walk to the grocery store and see my neighborhood, and I can change rooms in the house and see a different angle on my wife and the cats. But I feel like the threads of contact through the internet with the rest of the world are extremely valuable to me now.
Yeah, so you're keeping informed and staying connected with people.
I'm trying to, but it's a pretty passive exercise on my part. Like, I'll look at my phone now and again, and you know, I have a number of text threads that I'm, you know, very proud to be associated with that I hope will be immortalized somehow on my passing. You know, I don't want my quips and my jabs to be forgotten. But when I dunk on somebody in a text thread, more people should know about it. That's what I'm saying.
But these are your friends, I assume? You're not just having random dust-ups with people texting you?
Oh, yeah. They're all intimates of one kind or another, yeah.
Do you mind? I'm just curious. Who are some of the people you're engaged? I know they're texts, they're private,
well,
whatnot.
For example, there's a text thread that is everyone associated with electrical audio, like the people who live and work in this building, you know, and that text thread is for sharing information, but it's also for breaking balls. There's another text thread, which is a bunch of my cohorts in the poker community, like people who professional poker players and people who have an interest in poker and that I get on with socially. And that's a pretty wide ranging text thread. And then I have other very specific ones. There's the Vampumovi group. Vampumovi is an acronym that Tim Midyet came up with. It's a fake Italian word That's an acronym for very old men playing unfashionable music on vintage instruments.
Okay.
And the Vampamovi group is a self-identifying group of very old men who play unfashionable music on vintage instruments. And we communicate with each other in a sort of a knowing way that our tastes and our activities are arcane and slightly embarrassing, but we're still committed to them as a lifestyle.
What are some of the vintage instruments in question, if I may ask?
Oh, it doesn't matter, but I have a Travis Bean guitar that I've played continuously for 25 years, and it was old when I bought it. So
I see. It's not some, you know, archaic, what have you, like some sort of prehistoric instrument.
It's a guitar you've had a long time. I just mean, it's normal, okay, regular rockers who are, you know, sad and unpopular.
Right. Speaking of poker, I think we had an extensive conversation about your love of poker. Well, we've had a few of those, actually. But are you able to play poker virtually, online?
When the pandemic was in its lull a while ago, there were a few private games that started playing in a socially distant manner that seemed responsible to me, and I played in those games for a while until the numbers started to crest, and I was like, I just wasn't comfortable being in a room with other people, so I bailed. Those games are still going on, God knows why. Rest their
old
souls,
habits,
I guess.
Old habits die hard, I assume. Yeah,
yeah, I think degeneracy is a very strong motivator for some people.
Yeah.
There are some private online games that I play in where there are people who know each other socially. They play informally using various online vehicles. There's no official sanctioned way for U.S. citizens to play poker online. There are some gray market kind of U.S. facing sites that are not regulated in any meaningful way, where I don't feel particularly safe putting money. But
yeah,
there are some people who, because that's their profession, you know, they're sort of forced into that. There are some locales in the U.S. that allow for online poker, like New Jersey, Delaware, Nevada. And I can't remember if there are another one or two have joined the compact, but there are some places where you can play online poker legally in the States, and the professionals have all moved to those places. They've all gravitated there.
Just, that's interesting. They've moved to a place to play a virtual internet game?
Yeah, I mean, all of those places also have live poker, but so.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I know you've told me, I think, revealingly in the past that, you know, that is an income stream for you. You count it as an income stream. So
yeah, I mean, when I can't play, I miss the money. I really do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I read an article in a big magazine that you were featured in recently about the state of affairs in terms of your day job, your electrical audio, your studio. I think those interviews were recorded in the last few months. So. Mm-hmm. I think I know the answer to this, but as we're speaking, how would you describe the current state of electrical audio? How's it going there?
Well, I mean, we're in a global pandemic, and so it's fucking grim, you know?
Yeah.
People can't congregate safely. We run some sessions here at the studio in a socially distant manner, in a safe manner. And we try to be conscientious about disinfecting everything, and we have rather strict protocols about how people can behave in the building and how many people can be in here and that sort of thing. But honestly, I wish there was a national response that didn't require me to be open. I mean, I'm open now as a matter of necessity, so that the business doesn't completely collapse, but I would prefer not to, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're trying to do it as safely as we can, but there's been very little guidance in that regard. So we've had to consult with medical professionals and come up with our own protocols that we believe are responsible, but we have no assurances of that. We're disinfecting things and everyone's masked all the time, and we disinfect every article used in every session in between sessions, and all the rooms are disinfected after sessions, and I mean, we're trying to be conscientious about it, but we don't. There's no clarity about if we're whether we're doing enough or not. But the problems that we're having are not unique to us. It's just it's unsafe for people to congregate. So bands can't play gigs. There's no touring, so there's no income.
Yeah.
Bands can't get together to rehearse, so there's no songwriting being done. There's no material yeah. being prepared for recording. People can't go to record stores, so there are record stores closing, which means that one of the principal outlets for a revenue stream for recorded music is, you know, really poorly served right now by the online marketplace. Like, you can get records online, mm-hmm. but it's not the same experience as going to a record store.
Well, there's a social component that's obviously missing in a knowledge. You know, I learn things at record stores usually.
Right. I mean, I used to fantasize about, like, the perfect record store would be two completely obsessed guys, one completely obsessed with Willie Nelson, one completely obsessed with The Fall. And the whole record store would be nothing but Willie Nelson and The Fall, you know?
right.
So if you went there, you would learn something about one or the other of them, and you would probably leave with a great record, and you would have it explained to you by a guy who was intimate in it.
Yeah.
The only real problem would be if you went in to buy a Willie Nelson record and the Willie Nelson guy was at lunch and the Fall guy was the only guy in the shop.
I have been contemplating many of the things you were just discussing there. I have been ordering records, and in my own practice as a person who talks to cultural creators of all stripes, I have made the observation that I've never been busier. Like, I try to do this podcast once a week, but so many people are coming forth wanting to speak or agreeing to speak, and I'm doubling up, so twice a week, and it's a lot of work and all that stuff. But my observation, and I've raised this with other people, is a lot of what I'm buying, a lot of the people I'm covering, pretty familiar with them, and so what I'm missing is opening bands.
Yeah, new blood.
That new blood discovery. Like, I'm part or tapped into a pipeline of productivity that a lot of it was done pre-pandemic and it's just coming out now or what have you. And I do I'm sure you've noticed that people are making records. Lots of stuff seems to be coming out. But as I talk to them, they're like, oh, yeah, I made that. Like, I was done that in like February. So now I'm like, whoa, you know, we've been talking about all sorts of food pipelines, you know, being impacted by this pandemic. I'm waiting for, as you say, like, studio activity is, if not shut down completely, it's been minimized. Do you imagine we're going to see, you know, an absence of things in the next few months? Like, less stuff probably going to be coming out?
Well, some things have carried on. Like, as you said, like, file work. Like, people are working on old tapes and old material. Like, we had a massive archive project that came through here. Not long ago, I've done two or three sort of rejuvenation or reissue projects in the pandemic, and that's more than we would do in a typical year here. Like, there are things that are being done that are trickling out, but the incubation of new ideas and the, you know, like, house shows and neighborhood bars that have live music and things like that, that's where people get their sea legs and learn to perform in public. And, like, it's not even safe to have a garage band at the moment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean the literal garage band. I don't mean the
style.
It's not even safe to get together with your buddies and practice in your basement. It's just, I think it's just an awful year. We're going to need to wait everything out, and then we can pick our lives up again on the other side.
Yeah, I agree. But I am missing
Shellac, the band that I'm in, Shellac, had an album that was partially recorded, and we had a couple more songs to record, and we were planning on finishing it in June. We were in the middle of a tour in March when the coronavirus was, like, growing exponentially, and we canceled the tour, and we went to our separate homes, and we haven't been in the same room since.
Yeah, that's sad. I've heard Todd is not. Yeah, Todd understandably is not willing to come to Illinois and get together. Yes, that's
well, we wouldn't ask it of him.
Well, you know, yeah, that's true.
But yeah, it's a, it wouldn't feel safe traveling, and also like once here, one of the joys of being in a city like Chicago is that you get to, you know, see friends and go places and do things, and he wouldn't be able to do that while he was here if he would if we were rehearsing. It would be basically rehearsal in the pod with the three of us and then isolating otherwise, you know.
I get it. It is a shit year. We do have to wait it out. Was electrical I mean, obviously, relatively speaking, I'm sure it was doing just fine, but was it flourishing in the months before the pandemic? I ask this because I invoke the fact that, you know, a lot of people are releasing things that they made in professional studios, but it seems like at least particularly, I know it's been going on for decades, but particularly in the last couple of decades, there is a movement towards people making things at home, making things on their own. I just read this book called Mirror Sound by Spencer Tweedy. I don't know if you're familiar with this book. I know you know Spencer. It just came out, and I just thought, wow, what a weird. It's all about people. For those who don't know, it's all about people who make stuff, not only recording stuff on their own, but they often play everything by themselves. So it's really fascinating. So all of this to say, like, what does that trend had that trend already been impacting a studio like yours or studio business, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. Like I mean, the biggest indicator of it is the value of a day in the studio, the cost of a day in the studio.
Right.
There was a period when the studio was the only place you could record anything. So whether it was an audiobook or a radio jingle or a rock band recording an album, it didn't matter what it was. It had to be recorded in a studio. And so during that era, studio time was at a premium. And in the 70s and even into the 80s, studio time in Chicago was several thousand dollars a day for a proper studio like Electrical Audio.
Yeah.
To get a day locked out in a studio like this with a competent engineer would be several thousand dollars, you know. And now a day in Studio A at Electrical Audio is $600.
Yeah.
And our Studio B is $400. So, you know, nothing else that we pay for has gotten less expensive. Salaries haven't gone down. We haven't, you know, our taxes and utilities and the cost of living haven't gone down. But the cost that we can charge, the billing that we can do for a day in the studio has gone down just because there is now only a very select, very specific number of things that must be recorded in a studio. Essentially, everything else can be done semi-professionally at home.
So how do you feel about that? I've thought about you in this regard for some time because every once in a while I'll talk to a friend who has a studio. I remember talking to my friend Howard Billerman, who oversees
Howard's
the
a good
hotel.
Friend of mine as well.
Yeah, and he oversees the Hotel Tatango Studios in Montreal. And when I was there, he was kind of giving me a tour, and he said, because he knew you and I are you know, friendly friends.
Sure.
I dare say we're friends.
Go ahead.
He said, "Oh, you know, Steve, I asked Steve for some advice about this, and he helped me." And I was like, "Oh, that's great." And every once in a while, I've asked you for things. Actually, just this week, my friend Jim White, you know Jim White, the drummer?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Jim, he's like, oh, I'm trying. He's been posting all these things about how he wants to try to learn how to record his own drums. And he and I were texting. I'm like, you know, you should just, I bet Steve would help you. You have been very helpful to people who are, you've always been this way, it seems to me anyway. You always offer your expertise and help. There's YouTube videos of you spilling the beans.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you feel about this. Now everyone's taking these applications and you know, they're setting up in their own homes instead of, you know, coming to Electrical. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, that part of it I feel great about. I've, you know, enabling other people or empowering other people to do stuff that they want to do on their own, independent of everybody else. I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But the main thing is that I learned everything that I know how to do, I learned from somebody else. Like they taught me how to do it. They were generous with their knowledge with me. And so it doesn't seem reasonable that I should be proprietary about it with other people and keep it to myself, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there are some things that I figured out on my own, but I figured them out from principles that I did learn from other people, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, and also, there's also this, I'm not a competitive person. So I don't, it doesn't cheapen me if somebody else succeeds, you know?
Right, sure, sure.
So I feel like that's a kind of an ingrained element of the music underground, the punk scene, which is sort of where I learned how to be a human, in that you're not just doing something for yourself. Whenever you're participating in something, whenever you're doing something, you're not doing it just for yourself. Yeah. What you're doing is you're making everything better for everybody. And yeah. That's sort of the end goal of everything. Like, I didn't open the studio so that I could maximize my income. I opened the studio so that I would have a nice studio to work in, and then consequently everyone else would have a nice studio to work in, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the long and short of it. There's a misapprehension that a lot of people have about entrepreneurs or people who start businesses or enterprises, and they think that the reason that you're doing it is to make money. And the reason that you're doing it is because you're sort of compelled to do this thing, whatever it is, whether it's run a restaurant or run a bar or have a recording studio or make plumbing connectors or sheetrock or whatever it is.
Sure.
There's something about doing that that fulfills you, that animates you, that makes you want to carry on doing it. And in so doing, you know, you have to make money now and again to cover the cost of doing it and to pay the employees. And, you know, the ideal is that you would be successful at it and that it would provide you with a livelihood and a means to retire comfortably and all that sort of stuff. But the money is not the reason you're doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. For what it's worth, as soon as this stuff sort of started in March or April, I let it be known that, you know, I've been recording this podcast remotely for years. If anyone needs help, you know, setting it up, at the time, Zoom wasn't really happening the way it's happening now and all those sorts of things. So I'm like, send me a note. And sure enough, people are like, yeah, how do you do it? And, you know, how do you do a tape sync? How do you do this? And I think in the spirit of what you're talking about and, you know, as you know, I'm an admirer of yours, and I come from punk as well. So I felt, yeah, I want to help people. Like I think that is the right impulse, and I think it's important that we all help each other right now.
I mean, it's been kind of highlighted during the pandemic when when people are literally running out of things, and it, you know, but I think it's just a natural human impulse that if you like. Identify with your neighbors and your peers, and you see conditions deteriorating for them, that you want to do what you can to make them better.
Yeah.
And sometimes that takes the form of running a business, but sometimes it's just, you know, sharing what you have or helping somebody out in some other sort of tangible way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. Over the years, you have, I feel like no matter what the trends are, you have an ability to be proven right in terms of anticipating how music will best serve the musicians who make it and the fans who consume it. Obviously, this current suspension of, as you mentioned, live music is suspended. Studios are operating differently, if at all. So as we've established, this is obviously unprecedented for so many of us. But just as sort of to try to nutshell this, how do you think we'll get out of this and return to some sense of normalcy? Obviously, you mentioned the government intervention, like hopefully a change in America will impact, you know, your situation.
Well,
in particular.
There are two questions, like how do I think things are going to wrap up is one question. The other question is what would I like to see so that we could wrap it up? What I'd like to see is our government taking it seriously the way other countries have and pay people to stay at home and not go to work. Make sure that their rent is covered. Make sure that their living needs are seen to, and make it so that people don't feel obliged to go to work. That's one thing that I would like to see happen. And if we did that, and if everybody committed to staying at home for a couple of weeks, we would probably break the cycle of infection. And then that would cause case numbers to go down. That would take the pressure off of the hospitals. And that would mean fewer people would die, yada, yada. All of that would be, that would be a step toward ending it. Obviously, nothing is going to change until there is widespread vaccination and immunity. And I don't know how long that's going to take. It might take a year, you know.
It might take longer, yeah. I feel, you know, in our milieu, live music is such an important aspect of what we all do and you know, and in terms of making us feel certain feelings and all that kind of stuff. And it seems like the exact type of activity we won't be able to do until maybe 2022 safely. And anyway, I don't have a question there. I don't know. Do you feel differently about it? Do you think we'll be back at it?
I have no optimism in that regard. Like when the pandemic first started, people thought, well, we'll have a month or two of lockdowns and slowed down behavior, and then, you know, people will adjust to living with the virus, and people will change their behavior, and that'll slow the spread. And it didn't, and they didn't, at least not here. They did in other places, like, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Vietnam, like a lot of places. Canada has managed it way better than we have, you know, a lot of places.
Here and there, I would say. I mean, obviously, you know, we have our issues too. But yes, there's not, to your point, I don't think there was a national, you know, plan. It's provincial. It's similarly to, you know, the states in your country each have the ability to override, some ability anyway, to override, you know, federal legislation, I guess.
I mean, it's utterly insane that you have a country without internal borders, and then you have a communicable disease that's treated differently in Indiana than it is in Illinois.
Yeah.
It's just, well, it's utterly insane.
That's happening here, though, too, a little bit. So that, a lot. Like, we are, you know, we have rogue, you know, premiers. You have governors and senators and all that stuff. We have premiers, and they have political stripes. And so I live in a libertarian province, and it's very confusing. Like, my wife is completely, you know, we moved here to be closer to her family, but she's very frustrated. Like, our friends in Ontario, their kids are in school. Ours are not. We'd made the decision to keep them home. So we're frustrated too. And, so it's like, but we're also like, where should we live? Do we all move to Vietnam? Do we all move to Australia? What? It's, by the way, have you ever thought about leaving America? Steve, I wonder. You've traveled the world.
If Trump had been reelected, then I think there would have been there would be no future for me here.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think
seriously.
I mean, my wife has health issues. And especially with the raging pandemic, I just don't think it would be, I don't think the studio would survive. I don't think our healthcare system is conducive to people who don't make a lot of money staying alive. So yeah, I feel like it would have been a necessity. Or it would have been a very close call between staying and leaving if Trump had been reelected.
Okay, so let me just read between the lines here. What part of Canada would you have moved to?
I'm going to say Quebec, because I think Montreal is a beautiful city. The food is fantastic. I love the arts and culture scene there. But I have also I've also enjoyed Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
Vancouver has a lot of hedges, I noticed. There's hedges everywhere in
hedges?
Vancouver.
Yeah. Like the brushery, you mean?
Yeah, like around people's houses. There's a lot of topiary and hedges.
Interesting. A landscaping observation. I've not heard that. I never noticed that they have mountains. I've noticed the mountains.
Yeah, hedges was the thing that struck me.
okay, just greenery. I mean, it's known we're some parts of Canada are quite green, but sorry.
I've been to I've spent some time in Winnipeg. It's pretty cold there. Not so into the cold. Same with Calgary and Edmonton. Not so into the cold. I think Toronto's manageable in terms of climate. Montreal, it gets cold in Montreal, but it also seems like everybody's sort of immune to it there. They have everything figured out about how to get the snow out of the streets and that sort of stuff. So
You're a hardy Chicagoan, so I wondered. I've asked people in California this question. They're like, no, can't do it. I wouldn't be able to live in Canada, the weather. But you're a hardy Chicagoan. I would think you could deal with most of our climate
issues. Yeah, and I grew up in Montana, which is basically southern Alberta. So
yeah, right, exactly. Okay, so we'll hopefully, I mean, I will say, I don't mean this in a disparaging way. We don't want you here. I hope you can stay in Chicago. You know, it's not nothing personal by that. It's not a slight. I hope you can maintain. But it, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you named all the. I mean, I named all the places in Canada. I don't think there are any more. But Canada, Canada was actually on a short list with New Zealand and Australia. New Zealand is probably, you know, no offense, but New Zealand's probably the spot. Honestly, if you think about the English-speaking world, like New Zealand definitely has it over everybody else.
Wait a minute. Given your work, though, I mean, you can't be that remote that people aren't able to swing by your recording facility, wherever it might be. You need.
I mean,
people,
I'm operating under the assumption that the entire music industry collapses as well.
Oh, so. I see. Just vocationally, you would be switching as well. It wouldn't just be, you know, your passport that changes. Oh, okay.
I would
okay.
be a subsistence farmer, probably.
Oh, I bet you could do that. You grow a lot of stuff, don't you, in your home or near your home?
Yeah, I mean, sure. Yeah, I bet I could do that.
No, that's good. Here's the thing. I don't want to get embroiled in any mudslinging, but your name came up recently. Someone dropped your name, and it happens from time to time.
Elvis Costello. You know, he just can't. He won't shut up about me.
I don't understand it. I thought of Steve Earle. Remember Steve Earle a few years ago said something too?
I'd forgotten about that one. But that's that's probably because I'd forgotten about Steve Earle. So
I was actually offered a Steve Earle interview recently, and I was like, you know what? I remembered. I have a memory of an elephant. And I was like, what am I going to say to that guy? But my question here is, it's often about your recording. And I find it interesting because I always think when people lash out, there's a little bit of them that are they're a little threatened by something, maybe.
Nah.
They're not just
people like what they like. He doesn't like stuff. That's fine.
Okay, that's it. You just think it's an aesthetic thing. I just don't see why they would. The Elvis thing was interesting because he didn't even say your name. If you looked at it, it was like that guy who made that record doesn't know what he's doing. Like I looked at it's interesting. He didn't. Anyway, you just think whatever these people say.
I mean, opinions about me are for other people. I don't really. They're none of my business. You're okay. Welcome to them. Like I'm sure I have some opinions of Elvis Costello about Elvis Costello. I don't think they should matter to him either, you know?
Right. Sure. Okay. Fair enough. I think it's weird that your name is invoked in this way, but particularly since so many of us value what you've brought to recording. That's where I'm coming from. Like, I don't get it.
Right. But I mean, if you think about think about something atrocious, right?
Okay. I'm thinking about it right now. I got
okay,
it.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Like, there are... You know, like the stadium will be filled when the New York Yankees play in public again. You know, like just there's somebody that is really into stuff. There are people that are really into stuff and there are people that really hate it. And none of that bothers me. I don't consider it necessarily. I don't consider it wear like a badge of honor that Elvis Costello isn't into my recording work. But I just don't care. You know,
that's right. You shouldn't care. I just think it's weird. And you know, those of us who follow you and when your name's brought up this way out of the blue, you know, it's just like, why is Steve being mentioned in this way? It's odd.
The best one was when Marky Smith dropped my name in a song and said that I was in collusion with Virgin Trains.
He said that?
There's a Fall song where he says that that Steve Albini is in collusion with Virgin Trains. He's got like somehow I had it in for him and I'd made the trains run late or something.
Did you encounter him ever? Did you have any dust up?
Nothing significant. Yeah, we've been in the same room a few times. Like he played a festival that we curated because we asked him to, but he never spoke to me about it, you know. I don't have any Marky Smith stories.
Did
always
you?
Admired him, but I don't have any stories about it.
So when you curate something like All Tomorrow's Parties, and when you're a band like Shellac and everyone's choosing, was the Fall your choice?
I think we just had a kind of a group assent about a lot of bands.
Yeah. No, I'm sure you had a consensus on everything. I just wondered if you were like, did you... That's all. I'm just wondering, did you like, have
I don't
fall?
I don't remember whose idea it was. Okay. I would, right. You know, I would have named the fall, but I don't remember if it was me.
You know what got lost in the pandemic and everything else was the Houston Astros cheated at the World Series. What did you make of that?
Well, I'm actually friends with someone who worked in the organization of the Houston Astros and has since lost his job in the aftermath of the cheating scandal. So I am privy to a small amount of inside baseball on that inside bit of inside baseball. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's not really a gray area. It is, you know, it's obviously unsportsmanlike, if not specifically against rules, to have somebody stealing signs. And, you know, I think everyone involved should, of course, be ashamed of that behavior. Mm-hmm. But that also, that was a hell of a team, though. You know.
yeah. Well, it turns out they had a little bit of an advantage, though.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
it's like saying, Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire, that home run derby.
Yeah,
that was something else. But
I have a hard time for precisely that reason. I have a hard time evaluating all of these appeals to purity in baseball when historically you've had things like you've had team doctors supplying amphetamines to the players on a regular basis through the 60s and 70s, just like players like, you know, hopped up out of their fucking minds playing baseball because they had to play every day, you know?
Sure.
So, you know, and then you had, you know, people talk about steroids like they're some like magical invention that allowed people to become superhuman athletes. But you also had like Sandy Koufax was being injected with steroids before every game, you know,
sure.
That was just because he had a deteriorating elbow or deteriorating shoulder or whatever.
Right.
And he ultimately left the game because he thought that constant medical attention wasn't worth it. Like being injected with steroids and being in pain just wasn't worth playing baseball. So, like, it's none of this is new or novel. Or there's always been somebody trying to find an edge, and a lot of those edges are outside the borders of what is acceptable. And it, you know, I'm not one of those people who says that cheating is part of the game, and you can't blame somebody for trying to win. I do think people should be ashamed of cheating and blah blah blah. But also, it's not, you know. I think people should be more ashamed of having an awful color announcer, you know?
Sure, fair enough.
I think Joe Buck is a bigger crime against baseball than the Astros cheating. Yeah.
People really dislike Joe Buck. It's fascinating. Like if he's calling a game and I go on Twitter, he's just always trending and people just shitting all over that guy, and I see it, but I also am like, it seems like an inordinate amount of shit to be.
The thing is that there are a few archetype baseball guys, and one of them was Jack Buck, Joe Buck's father, right?
Yeah.
There are a few guys that did it like superlatively, like, you know, Vin Scully. Mm-hmm. And when you are in the game doing the same thing that those people did, you are going to be compared to them, you know?
Yeah. Well, who on a national level would you say is good at that right now?
Steve Stone is great.
Steve Stone. Okay.
Yeah. Steve Stone is great. He used to do color for the Cubs. He's with the White Sox now. He knows as much about baseball as anybody alive, and he can bring it up on point, in tempo, without being a dork about it. He's fantastic.
Okay. Steve Stone. All right. Well, we'll get this message to Steve. Let him know that he's appreciated somehow. Yeah, that's great. I want to wrap up here, just keeping an eye on the watches and the clocks. You talked about Shellac trying to make a record, and hopefully that can happen at some point in the next few years. I feel like one of the last times we spoke, there was a B-sides compilation that was being worked on. And
yep.
I will say, like you mentioned archive recordings, I will say, I don't want to go on a tangent here, but that's just what I do. It is interesting what we've received a bit of a gift of time, some of us anyway, in this suspension where we can tend to things, you know, some of us don't have to take the bus at 6 a.m. anymore. You know, we can work from our homes if we're lucky, if we're fortunate. But all this to say, you were already working on this sort of archive project. I feel like we talked about this 2 years ago.
Yeah.
What's the status of that thing, by the way?
Well, it's in work. We're still getting our shit together. We work very slowly, and even more slowly when we can't be in the same room together. Mm-hmm. I think informally we had thought we would want to put out our album of new material before we put out a collection of archive material. Just right. sort of on an emotional level, it seemed like a bit of a capitulation to do the compilation first. And so that was our plan, and we just never readdressed that plan. We just never revisited that decision. Maybe we should. I mean, if we're going to be on ice for another year, then we should keep that in mind. But
did I just initiate a band meeting? I just feel like
we're going to Zoom on Saturday. We're going to have our irregular Saturday band Zoom, and we'll commiserate, and maybe we'll bring it up then.
I assume it would be wrong for me to attend that meeting, so I'll just please take these notes back to the band and let them know that I think the B-sides comp. I think you're right, though. Why not? I mean, if you're going to be on ice, the last thing that came out was this excellent Live at BBC collection.
Yeah,
that was fantastic. So I think there is a clamoring for such stuff, and I assume you're still figuring out what is. I think the last time we talked, there was like a quality control conversation about what really should be on the B-side. It won't be comprehensive. It'll be like, well, you know, we weren't so hot on that particular.
Yeah, all of those are still open questions. I think we're ultimately just going to default to putting out everything in a form where everybody can get at it and let them sort it out, you know?
Great. Great. Awesome. Okay. Well, I appreciate the candor there, as always. Well, Steve, you know, I like to check in with you at least once a year, as you know, I think, and I appreciate this. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. I know it went a little dark, but are you okay? Was it all right?
You know, I'll live.
All right. Now, normally, first of all, plugs, electricalaudio.com, yes?
Yes.
That's the website?
Our website, we had some phishing and spam bot problems with our website through the forum and through some other corrupted databases, so we had to take our website down. We're gradually, inch by inch, putting it back together using new tools on a new server. But there is a website up at electricalaudio.com. And you can contact us through the website.
And so, again, if people want to, sessions, the studio is open. People could come by somehow to make records.
The studio is operating, like I said, under strict COVID protocols, but we are open.
There is some consternation about the forum being down. I assume it will be back in some form.
That's the plan. We're still trying to migrate everything to a new and more secure platform.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, that's cool. Normally, I ask people to go out on a song. You know, you're a musician. You write songs. You've made records. Do you want to go out on a song? Is there a shellac song or something we can go out on, or something else that you've been involved in personally that you know might be temporarily appropriate?
Just the other day, somebody brought to mind a band that I'd recorded a while ago and a particular song, the song On Parade by the band Electrolane. Really love that song.
We have to go out on someone else's song? I don't know if I can do that. I don't have their permission. Do you own the rights to that song?
No. I don't know what you mean by go out on a song. You mean you want to play a song?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought I end the interview by saying, you know, someone's talking about an album they made, so we go out on a representative piece from the record. In this case, you know, we're not talking about a new shellac thing or something, but I thought if you had if there's a song from your past that we could go out on. That's all I was getting at.
I don't have the energy to try to comb through all that crap right now.
Let me see if I can grab. I just grabbed the End of Radio compilation that I was referring to here. These Peel sessions are great, and I really enjoy the evolution of the songs. You know, I mean, to hear these songs from 94, what they were then, what they became. I think because we talked about Canada, maybe one of the versions of Canada could be a thing we go out on. Is there one that...
I think the live one, the one from the later session, it has a little nod to Bob and Doug at the beginning, I think.
Okay. Hey, what do you make of the fact that Rick Moranis kind of came back? I was surprised. He seemed to disappear. Did you see that?
Yeah, none of those people ever go away. They should be on your Mount Rushmore. I mean, not that you need a Mount Rushmore, but
I'm taking it under advisement. I'll spread the word. We need a Mount Rushmore, and the SCTV people will be on it. Okay, fine. We'll see if we can get that done. This is Canada by Shellac from, I have to get the record again so I get the title correct. Shellac, The End of Radio is the name of the release. And this is from the December 1st, 2004 Peel session. That was my mom's birthday. So that's nice for me. This is Canada by Shellac. Steve, thank you so much for your time, and I hope we speak again soon.
I hope it is. I hope we speak again, and I hope it's under better circumstances.
Sing along if you know it. Anybody from Canada here tonight? Take off.
Hoser.
We got a name, a song after you. Call it Canada. Imagine a country so blue. That's a Canada. I'm at a loss for words. Playing the sentiment. Insight implies substance. You and Canada.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Very, very special thanks to Steve Albini for returning to the Creative Control podcast, this time for the 589th episode of this show, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and available wherever it is you get your podcasts. All of the major podcast retailers have the show. But if you can't find an episode of the show that you've heard about, or you're looking for it and it's just not in any of those feeds because they have limitations about how far back in the history of a podcast they'll go, If you're looking for something like that, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, you can learn more about all of these things at my website, vishkana.com, which is spelled exactly the way it sounds. Also, you can like Creative Control on Facebook if you still use Facebook. I'd like out. I got to get out. I don't want to delete the page, but I... Anyway, no, that's the wrong mixed signals there. Please like Creative Control on Facebook so you can keep up with stuff, I guess. Pretty active on Twitter, though. You can follow the show on Twitter at Vish Creative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at Vish Khanna. Also, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain the existence of this podcast. Those donations really do help, and I value all of them. And you can donate whatever you like, and you can alter that amount at any point. So I hope you feel like you have a lot of freedom there to do what you like. I will say $6 or more grants you access to exclusive audio content. Usually I'm posting things from my interview archives that preceded this particular podcast. And again, $6 or more a month, you get access to extra stuff, bonus stuff. But again, anything you like. Learn more about all of this at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists. Also, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support of this show. As always, thanks to my friend Jim Guthrie. He lends me some music for the program, and I love him very much, and he's very talented. You can learn more about all of his music at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you. Thank you for listening to myself and Steve Albini in conversation again. I hope you enjoyed it and learned some things. I always find it very insightful to speak with Steve, someone whose work and music I've admired for a long, long time. And I hope I get to see Shellac play again somewhere down the line. I had the stacked the odds against me by moving to Edmonton because I've seen them, I don't know, like 10 times or something, and it's and I've flown around sometimes to see them, and I've driven around to see them. I really love them, but the prospect of them playing, as we're speaking, you know, playing anywhere is it's a little slim. But I hope we get to see Shellac and other bands play music again soon. And anyway, yeah, thank you for listening to Steve and I. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you may you know, subscribe to or follow the show, whatever you want to do, and maybe tell your friends about the show. That's how these things spread around the best. So whatever you got to do, you can also just do nothing. You may not even be listening at this point. You maybe have already bailed. That's fine too. Whatever you got to do to get by, I appreciate it. And I will talk to you soon, I hope. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.